Our guest is Lince Kashgarian. Ms. Kashgarian is the Program Director of the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her work on the federal budget priority highlights the militarization of the federal budget and the corresponding lack of investment in people on the planet. Her published reports include analysis of militarization in the federal budget, from the Pentagon and more to the militarization of U.S. borders and the militarization of law enforcement. Prior to her work with the National Priorities Project, Ms. Kashgarian was a researcher at the University of Massachusetts Donahoe Institute, where she conducted state and regional economic development studies. She holds a Master's of Public Policy from UCLA and a BA in Physics at the University of Pennsylvania. Good morning and welcome, Ms. Kashgarian. How are you?
Good morning, David. I'm well. Thanks for having me.
I would like to say it's a pleasure, but the subject at hand, I, like other people, just feel incredible amount of pressure in these hard times. And I'm reminded of something. I need to thank listeners like Sister Joy and others who chose to support this programming hour in the station. So I got that bit of housework done. It's not just something to check off. It's something to express to people that we greatly appreciate their support. I'm not sure if many of our listeners, I know a good number, are familiar with the Institute of Policy Studies and the National Priorities Project, but if you could just tell us about the work and the mission of NPP, and we can get started there.
Yes, David. So NPP, the National Priorities Project, was founded in 1983 in Springfield, Massachusetts, when a group of friends noticed that some of their local services were shutting down or cutting back on services. And what they were able to trace that back to was the Reagan administration and the cutting of federal funds for programs except the military. And so things like public libraries and public schools were suffering while the military had more money than ever. And we're in a very similar moment right now here. So, you know, from 1983, the project always of the National Priorities Project was to educate people about federal budget priorities, where the money is going, who is paying in, and how we can all affect that. Because we, you know, sometimes in our system, it can be easy to feel powerless. But if you understand the system, you understand the process, you have a better chance of having a say in what it is. And of course, you know, our members of Congress represent us in the end, and we're the ones they're accountable to. So it's all kind of a project to help people understand how it works and how they can have an actual voice in the process.
And given your work, in fact, I was checking some research, and in one regard, I was surprised, and another, I wasn't, but you all were nominated for a Nobel Prize in 2014, so that's
yes
to say implicitly how notable your work is.
Yeah, for our work, and that was the year I joined the project, so that was that was for all the work that had gone before me, actually, but yes, we were nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for our work on cutting the military budget because so many reasons, but you know, the U.S. has, and we'll get into, I'm sure, a lot of this, but we've had so many wars of choice, wars where the U.S., you know, Vietnam and Iraq and now Iran, and so many wars where different U.S. leaders have pulled the U.S. in. And then we also have a military budget where half of it goes to contractors. So there's lots of corruption, lots of sort of bad decision making, and yes, and so that's why we were not nominated for that.
Corruption, bad decision making, and then some. It seems, and you can calibrate this or correct me if I'm wrong, but the average person in this country finds out about the budget kind of after the fact. There, we're still yet to have a degree of civic participation where people are actively involved. We, both of you and I, mentioned earlier that it's somewhat that responsibility is somewhat delegated to our representatives. So if you could, I'll combine that comment with give us some budget basics. There's Just a budget 101, if you please, so we can get into the more contemporary current things.
Yeah, so the first point is sort of we find out about the budget after the fact. I think that's completely true. And it's partly a facet of how our system works. You know, we have a representative democracy. So we're counting on those people who go to Washington to represent us. But it's, I think, so much more than that. You know, it's the media that is constantly reporting on one thing or another, but again, not in a way that gives people understandable versions of this in ways they can understand. And often when the media does report on it, it all sounds like it's so far above our heads, right? So it doesn't, they're not telling you how you can have an effect for the most part, except for programs like yours. So there's that part of the problem. But yeah, how does the budget work? What's going on with the budget? So there's two parts of the federal budget. One is called the discretionary budget. I'm going to use some words that are probably not on your ordinary discussion, but there's the discretionary budget. That's the budget that Congress decides every year. And that funds most of what you think about that the federal government might do. It funds the military.
Including the defense budget.
It funds the war and weapons and the military. It funds public education. It funds public health, the, you know, Environmental Protection Agency, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, you know, any federal agency you might think of is probably in the discretionary budget, the Department of Education, all of these. Then there's the mandatory budget, which doesn't get touched every single year. These are programs, the biggest parts of them are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And so those are the programs where they just say, here are the rules. If you pay into Social Security and you hit the right age and you've paid into the system, you get your benefits. And they're not setting a certain amount of money. And when the money runs out, it's gone. So that's the way, that's called the mandatory budget. So there's these two different kind of budgets happening, these two different pots of money. But it's also kind of just all made up, right? So what you have sometimes, and what has happened in the last year, is that Congress has started taking from the mandatory budget in order to subsidize the military. And so last year, Congress cut Medicaid, which gives health insurance to 1 in 5 people in this country, and they cut food stamps, and they put a bunch more money into three things, into tax cuts for the wealthy, into the military for the war that we're currently having now in Iran and other things, and into Trump's mass deportation agenda. So they just shifted the money right over from one budget to another. There's nothing stopping them from doing that if they want to, except that there were lots of us, there were lots of groups that did participate in trying to stop that shift and that are still working to reverse it now. And so one way that people can actually get involved in this process is through those groups like the National Priorities Project and many others that are trying to affect this process, and where we will tell you what's going on. We will, you know, if you sign up for our list, you'll get an email, or if you follow us on Instagram, you'll see those things that will tell you what's going on so that you can also be part of the process.
And why don't you give out the address of the National Priorities Project, if you please?
Our website is nationalpriorities.org.
All right, now thank you. And the cuts that you refer to, am I mistaken, that puts about over 40 million people in jeopardy of not being able to sustain their lives normally? Is that correct?
There's a 40 million are risk of losing food stamps. That's how many people are on food stamps, and they're all of them are going to either lose food stamps entirely or see the value of their food stamps cut, which we know is the exact opposite of what people need right now because grocery prices are still through the roof. So there's that. There are 17 million people at risk of losing their health insurance under these rules. And some of those are the same people and some of them aren't. And so there's just millions and millions of us that are at risk. And of course, all of us are facing higher gas prices, higher grocery prices, and the cost of living. And instead of doing anything about that to help all of us get by, we have an administration right now that secured a $1 trillion war budget last year and is this year looking for a $1.5 trillion dollar war budget, and that would be higher than the budget during World War II. So it's really uncalled for, and I think it's also important to note that it may also be a negotiating tactic. You know, we have this president who comes in and says crazy things like we're going to take over Greenland and things, and then he gets something. You know, like he'll say the farthest out thing he can think of, and then he gets something that he wants. So we have to be on the lookout. We don't want to just stop a $1.5 trillion war budget. That's way too much. The majority of people in this country, 60% of people in this country agree that's way too much. But a trillion is also way too much. And we already have that. So we need to step it back to a place where the war budget and the military budget is actually on par with the military we need and not the military that somebody like Pete Hegseth wants.
And if I can note that the actual pay for people in military service is not adequate, I forgot at how many, but a good number of them are on some form of public relief or public support as well.
That's right. That's another thing that's shocking about cutting food stamps is that there are a good number of military families that actually depend on food stamps. But yes, there is the military pay is inadequate. And it's also not what's driving the military budget. You know, a lot of people think we have to keep the military budget high to show people to support our troops and to make sure the troops are taken care of. But again, half of this money is going to contractors. It's not going to the troops. And you have troops worked with families on food stamps. There is more than twice the amount of money going to contractors as going to troops for their pay. So it's not a problem. We can protect the troops' pay. We can give the troops a raise and cut the military budget at the same time.
And that's meant for projects that sometimes get canceled or are proven inadequate or underperforming.
That's right. There are so many weapons systems that at this point are giveaways to contractors, or they're giveaways to certain members of Congress who want that program. And sometimes it's because there are jobs in their district that depend on that program. And so that's a real factor. But what they should know is that we can create, if we take that same money, say the F-35 jet fighter, this is a program that Senator John McCain called a scandal and a tragedy, and he was as pro-military as anybody. This is a program that has gone billions of dollars over budget. It is years behind schedule, but it is the flagship program of Lockheed Martin, which is the biggest military contractor, and they've sprinkled jobs for this program all over the country. So they have members of Congress who are defending that, but people should know, the members of Congress should know, and the people who are in those districts should know that if we took that same money and invested it in healthcare or education or clean energy or even tax rebates, any of those things, we could create more jobs that way than by continuing to fund the F-35 at higher and higher levels. So, and those are jobs we need, right? We have nursing shortages in this country. We have construction shortages now. There are so many jobs that we actually need, and we should be funding those things instead of funding a program that enriches the biggest weapons contractor in the world.
Allow me to reintroduce you. Listeners, you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Wetzel. Most importantly, I want you to focus your attention on our guest, Lindsay Kashgarian. Ms. Kashgarian is the program director of the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. And we are talking about affordability. Where are we at economically? Why does it make a difference to each of us in our communities and what we can do about it, what we can first understand about our situation? Again, Ms. Kashgarian, thank you for being with us. I want to backtrack for just a second so we can move forward a little bit more efficiently. We both kind of glossed over but alluded to the responsibility of media in this and the fact that most people find out about the budget after the fact. There's some kind of buttons that my media colleagues push. The $37 trillion of national debt. Mm. Or let me see. I'm just trying to think of another button quickly here. No, we'll stick with that. And just start off with that again. Where is the budget at? What is our, like, what amount of money are we dealing with when we're dealing with any given fiscal year, particularly this one. And Hassa, I noticed something. I looked at the budget also over, I looked at a couple of graphs from different foundations. And the growth is just amazing after the 1990s. It just geometrically excels. So I've given you a mishmash of media buttons here. I just wonder if you could tackle them just for a second.
I'm happy to talk about the debt. And yes, that is a button that people push. And I think calling it a button that people push is accurate, because you push it and then people have all kinds of feelings about it and it sounds really bad. And but there isn't necessarily a lot of understanding of what that actually means. So yes, it's a big number. The debt is a big number. Our federal budget every year is also in the trillions. It's the, you know, this is, we're talking about a lot of money. It's money that, you know, most of us can bear. We can't wrap our heads around $1 trillion. That's $1 trillion is a number with 12 zeros after it. You know, most of us are lucky to see a number with 4 zeros after it. So that's, it's a huge, huge amount of money. It's a huge difference. But what's important to know is that the U.S. economy is also huge. And so if you think about it, like, you know, if one person takes out a $200,000 mortgage, that's a lot of money for a lot of people, right? But somebody, if you have a much bigger income, so you can have $1 million mortgage and it's fine. It's no big deal. So the size of the debt always is relative to the size of the U.S. economy. And the question is really, what can the U.S. economy bear? So the fact that it's a huge number, yeah, it's a huge number, but so is the U.S. economy. And so the debt right now, this is something people have been making a big deal out of also, is that the debt is about, now is about the same size as the U.S. economy. Well, that sounds kind of bad. That sounds like, you know, you don't want to have that much debt. But on the other hand, you know, to kind of bring it back to household terms, if you think about, you know, the size of your mortgage is probably bigger, at least when you first get one, is bigger than the size of your income. So these things aren't necessarily, you know, they, it's not clear that it's a problem. Japan does fine economically and has debt that's about twice the size of its economy. And the U.S. isn't even close to that. So it's very unclear, like, exactly at what point it could become a problem, but it's very, it's not at all clear that we're there yet. But what I will say is that we're taking out a lot of that debt for very bad reasons. You know, we're taking, we shouldn't be taking out debt to fund a war on Iran or to fund the war on Iraq, which we did, or to fund, you know, any of the wars that the U.S. has had in my lifetime or probably most listeners' lifetimes. We shouldn't be taking out debt for those wars, but we are, we have. We shouldn't be taking out debt to cut taxes for billionaires, but we're doing that also. You know, that we could cut down on that debt if we would appropriately tax billionaires. So that's not something we should be doing. But should we take out debt, for example, to transition to a clean energy economy? Yeah, probably, because that would pay for itself, right? That would actually pay off. So it's a really, it's a much more complicated question than just how big is the debt and is debt bad? Sometimes debt is bad and sometimes it's actually probably a really good idea. So it's important to kind of think about what we're really talking about here. You know, most of us are happy to get a mortgage if we can get one. Debt isn't always a bad thing. So, you know, so
medical emergencies, education.
That's right.
So there are a number of things, social and physical infrastructure.
Yes.
I mean, and the reason I prattled that at you is because some commentators, including yours truly, we've always been a country in a perpetual state of conflict, if not war.
Yes.
And it seems like our economy, our way of being is wedded to this matrix that we're discussing here today.
Yes, and certainly our politics is very wedded to it. I mean, every time you're somebody talk about debt in politics, it's always a bad thing. But like I said, if we could transition to a clean energy economy, that would more than pay for itself. You know, if we could.
And quite frankly, I can only think of two historical periods, the New Deal and the, pardon the expression, the War on Poverty programs are the ones that seem to be the more upfront policies about if we invest socially for the benefit of communities, we will get returns that go far beyond the actual dollar sign.
That's right. And there are so many more examples of where we should be doing that. You know, the childcare is a huge one. If we would invest in free and affordable childcare for every child in this country, that would pay for itself multiple times over. So there are so many, and, you know, education, there are so many examples of this. Probably a lot of job creation. You know, I was just, the U.S. right now is in the midst, we have a shortage of construction workers and we have a shortage of housing at the same time. Gee, it would be nice to fix both of those things and create more housing so that housing gets more affordable for people and we can all find an affordable place to live, and also create those jobs for construction workers at the same time. And I might add, part of the problem here is that people aren't willing, is that we have this politics where we're not willing to welcome immigrants to be those construction workers. But many construction workers are. And you know, if we would welcome them in and make it legal for them, then that would also prevent those employers from, they're hiring undocumented people so they can keep those wages low. But we don't want that either. So bring them in, document them, let them do the work, let them build the housing, let us have the housing. Housing can become more affordable. Everybody would win.
We're talking to Lindsay Kashgarian. Ms. Kashgarian is the program director of the National Priorities Project. And you hear us referring to the budget, but we're really talking about the issues of affordability given our present situation. Our time has quickly passed by, dear friend. And here at WPFW, we part of our service to the community is to do public service announcements. So here they come. We're going to take a short break. We're going to ask listeners to stick with us, and we'll have more about affordability after these messages.
On Tuesday, May 26th, WPFW presents All Blues, a Miles Dewey Davis centennial birthday celebration, 5 a.m. until midnight. Davis is one of the most influential figures of the 20th century, transforming music, fashion, and art. His life was complex, marked both by amazing accomplishment, like being one of the founders of bebop, and marred by incidents of domestic violence. Our special will unpack all of that. That's All Blues, a Miles Dewey Davis centennial birthday celebration, beginning at 5 a.m. on Tuesday, May 26th, on WPFW, your station for jazz and justice.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. I always say, more importantly, let's focus on our subject at hand. It's affordability. Our guest is Lindsay Kashgarian. Ms. Kashgarian is the program director of the National Priorities Project, commonly referred to as NPP, at the Institute for Policy Studies. So we talked about an overall framework, but I'm mindful of reports and articles that your group has done. What has the average taxpayer paid in 2025?
So, yes. So every year at tax day, we do a tax receipt to show people where their tax dollars are going. This is another thing where it's hard to understand the budget. We don't get a lot of information about it. This is maybe even something the federal government should be doing for us, is telling us where our tax dollars are going, but they're not. And so every year we say, it's tax day, we're going to put out a tax receipt, show people where their income tax dollars are going. And so it's income tax dollars only. And so you also pay other taxes. If you get a paycheck, it'll show your income tax, but it'll also show you're paying other specific taxes for Medicare and Social Security. So we're not counting those. We're just counting the income tax. But we show that for the average taxpayer, paid about $20,000 in taxes last year in 2025. Now, that's the average, is an income of about $100,000. So if your income is lower than that, you're paying probably a lot less. But this is the average. So about $20,000 in taxes, and about $4,000 of that is going to the war budget and to weapons, and about $1,800 is going specifically to weapons contractors and military contractors. So that's Lockheed Martin, it's Raytheon, it's these creators of these weapons systems. They're taking down half of the Pentagon budget. And they're taking, you know, compare that to how much went to the troops for their pay. And the troops' pay was only a little over $700 that the average taxpayer paid. So you're paying well more than twice as much to the contractors as you are to the troops. And this is bearing in mind that the average CEO pay at the top five Pentagon contractors was $24 million. And so we're paying those salaries quite directly. Our tax dollars are going to for these, you know, outrageous salaries of these, essentially, they should be public corporations. I mean, they're, Lockheed Martin takes over about three quarters or more of their revenues from our tax dollars from the federal government. So so these are public programs and they're paying these kinds of salaries. Meanwhile, as we talked about earlier, a lot of troops for their families are relying on food stamps to feed their families. And just to kind of compare that to some other programs, the average taxpayer paid, you know, that same person who's paying $4,000 for the war budget and $1,800 for Pentagon contractors would have paid just $124 for school nutrition programs, so school lunch and breakfast programs. And these are programs that feed millions of kids. 30 million kids depend on the school lunch program. And it could be more probably if we would make school lunch free for everybody. So it's just an example of how the kind of wealth and riches that we are pouring into the Pentagon and into these contractors, while we're really just being really cheap with things like schools and other programs that could make our lives better and could make the future of this country better.
Well, I want to get to the Medicaid figure, which I understand from your report is almost $2,500 for Medicaid. And that would cover about 68.5 million Americans.
That's right. Right. Almost 70 million Americans are getting their health insurance through Medicaid. Health insurance, as everybody here, everybody listening knows, is wildly expensive in this country. And so if you don't get it from your job, it's very hard to afford. One in five people, almost 70 million people, depend on Medicaid for their health insurance. And yet the average taxpayer is putting so much more into weapons and war than into this Medicaid program. And I just want to remind people, you know, I think the thinking of what the military budget is, and a lot of us sort of have the default assumption that this is a system that's built to keep us safe. And that is its core function. That should be what its function is. But I want to remind people of what our military is actually doing. And that is 20 years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan that did not pay off, that did not make us safer, did not make anyone safer. That is now who knows how long of war in Iran. That is the invasion earlier this year of Venezuela, a country that was posing no threat to the United States, did nothing to us. And, you know, Iran likewise, the excuses for the war in Iran are also just false. It's very much a repeat of the excuses that were made for the Iraq war and the lies that the second Bush administration told to start the Iraq war. We're told that they have these weapons and it's a threat to us, but it wasn't true then and it's not true now.
And since we're on that particular point, first of all, the war has not been declared by Congress, so it's sort of a conflict, but then again, it's not. I've heard from various media sources that it might be costing us $1 billion a day. And we don't have clear budget figures in relationship to that engagement. Am I wrong on any of that?
No, you're right on all of it. And what I think to me is especially shocking is, yes, we don't have any accurate figures or official figures on what this war is costing us, but neither do members of Congress. Even they can't get answers out of this Pentagon. And that is such a fundamental breakdown. I mean, yes, the president is supposed to go to Congress to authorize a war. And it's funny because if you, you know, it's not funny, but it's alarming because if you ask the president or you ask the Secretary of War, Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, they'll call it a war or not call it a war, depending on what suits their purposes. You know, the president said the other day, or just a few weeks ago, said that we can't afford things like childcare and healthcare because this is a quote, we're fighting wars. So what wars are we talking about if it's not Iran? This is clearly a war. And yes, he is supposed to go to Congress to get authorization for that, and he hasn't. It's clearly past the point now where presidents are allowed for up to 60 days to kind of do their own thing and respond to a threat. But after that, they do have to go to Congress, and we are past that point now. So that's clearly a violation of our own laws. But I think what's really also needs to just come up over and over again is that this war was not started to keep the United States safe. It's not necessary to keep the United States safe. Iran was not about to have a nuclear weapon. There was a nuclear weapons agreement with Iran that was working very well up until the first Trump administration. And then the Biden administration didn't restart it. And that's a shame because it was working. But this is not a war that we need to keep us safe. And Congress doesn't know how much it's costing. What we know about the cost, we know that at the beginning it was costing close to $2 billion a day. And then it seems to have ramped down a little bit to $1 billion. The best estimates we have now are in the range of $50 to $70 billion total for the war so far. But those costs are still going up. You know, we still have all the equipment, the ships, the jets, the troops, they're all still there. It's still, the costs are still climbing every single day.
And yeah, you mentioned the claim of the nuclear weapon threat. Just to bring it back home, one of your reports says that the average was $136 for the average taxpayer in 2025, and $57 for aid to foreign militaries as well. I just want to include that since we often overlook that in at least the mainstream media.
Yeah.
One translation you put on this is that 50 of a person's work days of income tax, 50 days of work, would go to weapons and war, with 23 work days paying for taxes for Pentagon contractors. So I just wanted to mention that. You know, the comparison or the scale is, and I'll let you be discretionary. You've been very kind and I think methodical and patient with our audience so they can catch, I think they're getting the gist here. But when you put it to scale, it's really out of scale. I mean, $19 for the Federal Aviation Commission, or another $19 for the U.S. Postal Service, or if we spend $16 for home and heating assistance, you know. Again, you're talking these two-digit numbers in comparison to hundreds and even thousands of dollars in the other categories. I'm going to give you some discretion here. Is there anything else you wanted to say about comparisons or alternatives?
Yeah, I mean, so since you brought up the $136 for nuclear weapons and $57 for aid to foreign militaries, I'll just say, you know, we do need alternatives to going to war. The world is full of problems and full of conflict and full of danger and full of bad actors. But just for comparison on that too, the average was $49 for diplomacy. So, and that's the alternative. That's what we need more of in order to deal with all those problems in the world. So I would just point that out. And this is something where, you know, the Trump administration, the first time and this the second time, has absolutely gutted the State Department and our diplomatic programs. So they're, you know, doubling down on war and cutting back on the State Department. And this is something where, you know, Trump's own Secretary of Defense in his first term, Jim Mattis, said, you know, if you cut the budget for the State Department, you have to raise the budget for bullets. I need more bullets. So it's a direct connection. Everyone acknowledges it. And it's going absolutely in the wrong direction right now.
To put even the conflict aspect aside, which we shouldn't, I certainly agree with that. People are suffering and dying because we don't respect the proportionality of our participation, a fancy way of saying when you withdraw from, you know, U.S. aid that provides medical and food services to people,
right?
People die, children die, older people die.
That's right.
And the destruction also is not just merely immediate. We're destroying structures that are going to be very, very difficult to recreate.
That's right. There, you know, over decades, the United States has contributed to building health clinics and public health networks around the world. And you're right, that infrastructure is just being decimated, and it will take years, if not decades, to build back to where it was, if we even are able as a country to make the decision that we want to build it back to where it was. And not to, you know, go too far astray, but people have probably heard the news of the Ebola breakout in a few countries, and that could have been caught earlier, quite likely. A lot of experts think that could have been caught earlier if the U.S. aid programs had not been pulled down in those countries. So it's a real problem. We were talking about media a bit earlier, and the role of media. And so I also want to point out that this administration also shut down the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which was a media agency that, you know, provided news to people. That on your tax bill last year was, and you know, it's shut down now, but $2 is what that was costing people. So, you know, media can be extremely cost effective. It's, you know, it doesn't cost a lot, but it's worth it. And they shut down one of those. And of course, you know, we have programs like yours, but then we also have a media environment that's dominated, you know, by these big media conglomerates that are not necessarily serving the purpose of actually educating people.
Well, I'm mindful of a few things. One, I want to remind listeners that you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, and we are speaking to Lindsay Kashgarian. Ms. Kashgarian is the program director of the National Priorities Project. We're talking about affordability in the budget in our present economic situation. I want to remind people that you have my gratitude, as well as that of many programmers and staff, given our recent spring membership fundraising drive. We take your support not for granted. It supports programming like Africa Now with host Muwiza Mutale at 1 o'clock. It's a program dedicated to African descendant people, not only in the continent, but throughout the diaspora. Mindful that we're in the month of May and mindful of Malcolm X's birthday, you'll find out his influence on Kenyan activists this afternoon. After that, Shai Wanana with Zen El Amin covers Middle Eastern affairs. And at 3 to 5, Sophie's Parlor, music and culture by women but for everyone. All those are good reasons to support WPFW, trying to build a better world one broadcast at a time. And I thank you for your participation in that. Ms. Kashgarian, thank you again for being with us. Last month, the Institute for Policy Studies and the Yale Center for Public Theology and Public Policy issued a report, The Moral Failures of Trump Budget Policies, How They Make Poor People Poorer to Pay for War and to Help the Rich. It's said that budgets are moral documents, indeed reflective of our commitments, whether it's those that we designate to represent us or our commitments as society. This is the only time I'm going to say it. I rarely want to refer to it as the Big Beautiful Bill. But what did the Big Beautiful Bill do? What kind of situation are we presented with?
Yeah, well, we call it the Big Ugly Bill. So this was passed last year. It was Trump's special bill. It was passed with Republican support, and it did exactly that. It took from programs for the poor in order to help the wealthy and to militarize the country. So it did, for example, nearly $1 trillion over 10 years of cuts to the Medicaid program. Millions of people are expected to lose their Medicaid. And, you know, especially for anyone listening who may be relying on Medicaid, those cuts haven't actually happened yet.
It's 14 million that are in jeopardy, right? And the cuts come later this year, right?
Yes, and it comes later this year. That's right. The timing is so insidious because the Medicaid cuts will take a place after the midterm elections. And so, and that's not an accident. That's, people won't realize what's happened until it's too late. So people need to know now that that's coming because there's something that they can do about it. So there's that cut. They cut almost $200 billion over the next 10 years from food stamps. So that's where, and it's everything from some people who get food stamps won't be able to get it anymore, including people who are caretakers of children or older family members. And so they have, you know, may not be working or may be working less than full time, but they have real reasons why. Those people, it's also going to cut back how much your food stamps are worth. So, you know, as hard as it is to stretch those at the grocery store now, it's going to get even harder. It cut those things. And then,
yeah, I was just going to say, since you paused, 40 million people rely on supplemental nutritional assistance programs. Yes. 40 million. Our current population is over 342 million. So 40 million out of 342
more than
million.
One in 10.
And not only your projections, but others are projecting that 4 million people are expected to see either their food stamps terminated or cut substantially.
That's right. Actually, everyone on food stamps is going to see them cut effectively because they're not going to adjust for inflation the way they have in the past. So like I said, it's going to be, they're going to stretch less far. So it's every single one of the 40 million, but 4 million people are expected to actually completely or have their benefits cut by a significant amount.
I'm trying to let you keep your momentum, but I wanted to interject, since you talked about healthcare earlier. You know, rural hospitals have been up in the picture of things, and we're really talking about, even under present circumstances, they're struggling to exist as it is.
That's right. This only
makes things worse.
That's right. So there are hundreds of rural hospitals that are seriously at risk of shutting down because the finances of being a rural hospital just can't work out without government help. And of course, if you live in a rural place, you're still just as likely to need a hospital. For any number of reasons, you know, including just routine things like, you know, childbirth, like you're having a baby, you need a hospital close by. There are hundreds of hospitals that are at risk of closing down because of changes from this big, ugly bill.
I'm mindful that we're getting squeezed for the time with about 4 minutes left. We haven't talked much about immigration and deportation. What's the, I hate saying this, the investment there from this bill?
Well, yeah, so this is such an important thing to talk about right now because Congress is acting this week to put more money into Trump's mass deportation, mass detention. This program got a huge infusion of money from the big, ugly bill. They got $170 billion from the big, ugly bill, and they haven't spent the vast majority of that yet. So they have tons of money already, and Congress this week is about getting ready to give them another $70 billion on top of that. And what we're seeing as a result of that is we're seeing families separated again, parents deported without their children, U.S. children, young, you know, toddlers left here in the country without their parents. We're seeing people, including children, put into detention centers, which is in jail. They're not going to school. They're not receiving medical care. They're not receiving, you know, they're kept apart from their communities and the rest of their families. It's just absolutely inhuman what these programs are doing. And the Congress that we have is pouring billions of dollars more into this week.
And I just want to give people a sense of scale. Thank you for the benefit of this report. 6,200 children are being detained thus far in this second term of this administration.
That's right.
A half a billion dollars spent on having a National Guard in Washington, D.C., Portland, Oregon, Los Angeles, and Memphis and Chicago. And I didn't even include Minnesota in that.
Right.
This is really tough. You know, it's this is not the G8 and awful show, but I wonder how, with just about 2 minutes left, where do you want to end this conversation for now?
I want to end this conversation with saying that the big ugly bill was bad. They're planning more of all of it for this year. So what folks should do is follow an organization like mine, you know, National Priorities Project or something or another one that will keep you up to date on this. Because if we are going to stop this from getting worse, we need people calling their members of Congress this week, this year, this summer. It's going to keep going on.
Well, Kashdarian, thank you very much for being with us again. We've been talking about affordability in the last aspects, particularly in regards to the budget. Ms. Kashdarian is, again, the program director at the National Priorities Project, and I'm sure we'll be engaging more issues regarding affordability and on the positive, sustaining our communities and hopefully building a better world in spite of it all. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much, David.
You're welcome. My thanks to Brian Bernard, our engineer for the hour, the News and Public Affairs Department at WPFW, and you, the listener, for supporting this station. Can't thank you enough. Coming up next, don't forget the blues. We do that every noontime, the Wednesday edition with Clarence the Blues Man Turner, and hopefully we'll meet again sometime on the radio soon. Take care.